This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For nearly a decade, Molly O'Neill and her brother Paul were the most popular people in New York City. Molly wrote restaurant reviews and articles about food for the New York Times, and Paul's power hitting helped the New York Yankees win a World Series. The O'Neills started out in Columbus, Ohio. Molly made her way all over the country, cooking in places like the Hospitality Motor Inn. She also learned to make nonviolent food for a feminist cooperative in Northampton, Massachusetts. Along the way, she became a celebrated chef and cookbook writer, and she perfected the family trait of exaggeration and hyperbole. She chronicled her life and career in her book, Mostly True, A Memoir of Family, Food, and Baseball. Her love of regional American cuisine is the subject of her new book, One Big Table. Molly O'Neill's in town this week to preside over a food culture symposium for students at UNC Chapel Hill. But first, she joins me in the studio. Welcome to the State of Things. So good to have you here.
Great to be here.
You were the only girl and oldest child in a family of eight. So you're kind of a mini mom to all those guys?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we were eight because there were my parents. And then I had five younger brothers. And there were also many, many Great Pyrenees dogs.
Did you have to feed them, too?
Yes.
Somebody did,
yes,
right?
They did.
And I understand that you gained some fame around the house. At least the guys really appreciated your art with Spam and cheese.
Well, our parents were a real problem. They were committed. They practiced a separation of food groups. And we were growing up in Columbus, Ohio. We weren't allowed to have casseroles. It was anti-American, and we were terribly humiliated by it. And they also didn't believe in fast food, and they didn't believe in junk food. My father was from a farm in Nebraska, and he thought fast food was a communist plot. And my mother was from a very well-to-do family in Ohio, and she thought that anything in plastic was for other people.
Wow. So, now tell me about casseroles. This is interesting because I sometimes think of casseroles as the all-American food, but not so in your family.
Oh, no.
No.
No, no. Everything, you know, we had meat, we had vegetables, yeah, we had potatoes, we had dessert, we had salad, and all of it was homemade and none of it was processed. And, you know, when I was growing up in Columbus, Ohio, it was a test market capital for new food products in
really?
The United States.
What would you describe Columbus, Ohio? Does it have something that you might identify as regional cuisine?
Oh, my goodness, it has so many things that I would identify. McDonald's, White Castle, Arthur Treacher's Fish and Chips,
yeah,
the Third Kentucky Fried Chicken. I mean, it was massive. But, you know, I'll tell you the real wake-up call is that I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And when I was traveling around America to collect recipes for One Big Table, returning to Columbus was really a comeuppance. It is one of the most exciting places, yeah, in this country right now. It's a totally altered landscape.
Well, how has that happened? Because, you know, this area, too, is noted for its up-and-coming food culture,
yeah,
here in this region. So what's happening to places?
I think a few different things are happening. First of all, the national food IQ has really leapt. It's just risen. It's not that we invented great cooking. My generation of the Alice Waters, et cetera. People ate beautifully in America from the very, very earliest times, but only a few people ate very beautifully. And we're seeing that much more widespread today, a much higher level of food consciousness of where food comes from and what it means to eat cleanly and eat well. But the other thing that's happening at the exact same time is that the 1965 immigration bill has changed the ethnic landscape of America, and we're no longer seeing ethnic populations limited to ghettos in large cities on either coast. They're in the suburbs, and they're in the suburbs becoming the middle class and, you know, creating fabulous restaurants and great supermarkets. And there's a vitality that's happening that's just it's irresistible. I had to leave Columbus to find that, you know, in the early 80s. Today, I wouldn't leave Columbus.
That's an interesting thought because of that immigration revolution, particularly, say, after the Vietnam War,
right,
begins there, and then with immigration from Central America. For some Americans, the only kind of ma and pa restaurant that was left was a Vietnamese, mm-hmm, restaurant, mm-hmm, or a Salvadoran restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they were discovering that, oh, yeah, you can actually make food that doesn't come wrapped and down the chute.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh.
And I think health concerns, and we've had a prolonged period of prosperity that now seems to be a memory, but but we did have an extraordinary period of peace and prosperity. And during those periods, cultures always leap forward in all expressions of culture, food being just one of them, you know, art, dance, theater, music. Food is an expression of who we are and where we live and what we care about.
I'm interested to know a little bit about your personal story as well, because you did, in fact, cook at the Hospitality Motor Inn.
That was my very first job. I didn't cook there. I was a waitress, and I've always been very interested in efficiency. And my first party that I waited on was the I was a waitress at the Ohio State Republican Convention in 1969. And I had a big table of about 20 people, and they all ordered a flambéed beef kebab, tenderloin tip. That's what it was. And I thought, why should I ignite each one individually when I could get it all done at once? So I ignited the rolling serving cart, which in turn turned on the Ansel system and made short work of the convention. And there, I was moved to the kitchen.
There's an irony there. Market efficiency gone awry at the Republican convention in Ohio.
There you go.
How are the big tippers?
I don't know. I mean,
yeah, I guess after that,
I don't think I ended the meal in that dining room.
I'm guessing you didn't get a tip. now, then you go from there to a nonviolent food for the feminist co-op.
Well, I was in a feminist co-op that, and we opened a women's restaurant that served nonviolent cuisine. Yes. And that was in Northampton, Massachusetts. And that was when I learned once again the power of food. And began really thinking about where does food come from, what matters, what is our relationship to food. I mean, I can spoof and rift on those years because we were completely ridiculous. That said, it was the beginning of a lifelong dialogue.
Because you're talking about vegetarian cuisine, so you're talking about thinking about where the food comes from,
right,
how it's processed.
Right.
And that's
right,
what you say you've taken with you.
Right. What happens to the animals? What happens to the land? What of ourselves are we putting into the food that we make and give to someone else?
So how'd you get to the New York Times?
Well, all these things just sort of added up. I mean, at the time that I ran restaurants. I went to cooking school at La Varenne in Paris. And at some point, somebody asked me if I'd ever considered writing about food. And, of course, I never had. I was a poet and a painter, and food writing would have been, by my standards, a lower art form. But after 10 years in professional kitchens, it sounded really, really good. And I wrote a story for the Boston Globe. I was hired by Boston Magazine very shortly thereafter. I was hired by New York Newsday to be their restaurant critic and a feature writer. And I went almost directly to the New York Times. I had a combination of skills that were very rare at that point. I could flip a burger and I could write a sentence. And those used to not go together. I mean, as I was driving here today, I was saying to Kelly Alexander, you know, if I were starting out today, the competition would be so stiff I wouldn't even consider thinking about food writing. Food writing wasn't something people had as an aspiration. It was really a plan B without a name. And it was the ultimate kind of liberal arts exercise and a way to live on the lunatic fringe and still make a living.
Well, Kelly Alexander is a food writer who frequently appears on this program, and she has written a book about Clementine Paddleford, an early food writer. And we've talked about that on this program with Kelly, who wrote the biography. What about her work, Clementine Paddleford's work, appeals to you? Did that in any way inspire you?
Well, Clementine was such an adventurer and also a Midwestern woman who went to New York and rose up to become a household name at a time when women just didn't do that. She also took a very muscular view of what was going on, and she was a very serious journalist. She wasn't a home economist writing about 10 different ways to use gelatin. She was, you know, getting her pilot's license and going into lumber camps and seeing how does this section of America eat? How does this little place eat? What are these people doing over here? She never stopped. The girl was just indefatigable, and she was, to me, a major role model in that she wasn't afraid to leave New York and find out what was going on in the country. So when I started traveling the country 10 years ago to gather recipes and food stories from Americans, anytime I got tired, I would look at her book and think, who are you to be tired? Just keep moving.
Well, you did. Your book, One Big Table, over 1,000 pages long, lots of food. Of course, it's a big country. We got a big appetite. What did you eat that surprised you the most?
Golly, that's a great question. I think what surprised me the most in the 10 years that I traveled around America was a profound shift in eating in America. And the fact that the most interesting food in America is not in our great, highly, you know, acclaimed city restaurants. It's in tiny, tiny isolated communities around America. And geographic isolation, ethnic isolation, language isolation, political isolation, any form of isolation creates a community that tends to revolve around cooking. And you can eat beautifully in very, very interesting ways. And I wouldn't have known that had I not been, you know, traveling back roads and really listening to things that people said to me and having potluck dinners all across America to gather recipes.
Well, Molly, I know that you are in town to address the local college students at a symposium at UNC Chapel Hill. Two of those students are with us today. Lauren Wilson grew up on a 200-year-old dairy farm in Bakersville, North Carolina, and she is the first food studies major at UNC. Hello, Lauren.
Hi.
It's nice to have you here. And Anna Castle is an international comparative studies and documentary studies major at Duke University. Hello, Anna.
Hi.
Both Lauren and Anna are students in the Cultural Foodways class at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. And let me ask you both, and I'll start with Lauren. What makes you think that foodways are the stuff of documentaries?
Kind of getting to what Molly was saying, foodways, I think at least what we've done in Kelly's class kind of show us how we relate to a larger community around us, no matter where we may be. And also in my experience, having grown up on a farm, how we relate to the environment around us. And so for me, that's kind of what has put value on that.
How about you, Anna?
I think there's automatically a story associated with food. So that's perfect for documentary because everyone has some sort of like intense personal relationship to food and a lot to talk about, which we've learned in our class.
Well, Lauren, I know you brought along with you part of your essay for that class. It's about nostalgia in the farm, and I think you read a piece by Edna Lewis, who cooked at the Farrington House, and her piece was called What is the South? And you answered that question in a way with your essay about the Wilson Dairy Farm. So will you read it for us?
Sure. Okay. The Wilson Dairy is a Silver Queen corn cob sopping in butter, salt, and pepper. It is breaking the heel of my plastic Barbie high heels while climbing the driveway with a sweating gallon of milk and sweetly sour blackberry seeds stuck in between my teeth. The Wilson Dairy is pulling back the tomato cages that cover heavy branches weighted down by blood-red beefsteaks. It is the heat pulsing from the screen window at the height of canning season and my meemaw saying, "Now, honey, you're going to ruin the whole batch if you don't start paying attention to my hands." It is the broken brown skins on the yellow cherry tree at the height of June. The Wilson Dairy is try and try again, but honey, that'll do for a place around the table.
Lauren, let me ask you that. First of all, that's a wonderful description of life on the farm, and it makes me want to go there right now. with an assignment like this, you obviously came to the class with some ideas about the importance of food and our relationship to the environment, et cetera, what you just said. And then you write a piece like this after reading Edna's piece. How does that change for you? What happened to you in the process of writing this?
The process of writing this, honestly, I sent that piece out to many people I know, having grown up in the South. But the way I reading her piece kind of changed how I related it to my own experience was the way she turns that place into it's the subject. It's something that's doing something. So thinking about that experience, growing up on a farm from that way, I was able to turn, you know, being at the Wilson Dairy, growing up there, into a subject that acted as opposed to me being the subject that acted. So
Well, that's good. Anna, you brought along a part of your essay as well in response to one of the world's most popular recipes. It's Marcella Hazan's famous recipe for roasting a chicken with nothing but salt, pepper, and a couple of lemons. Will you read your essay for us?
Sure, yeah. We wrote this after actually making the chicken in class and eating it. And I wrote, Marcella Hazan's chicken with lemons begins as a dead animal from a nearby farm. A skinny, clammy, pink, hollow corpse slathered in salt with a 20 times pierced lemon in its cavity in place of functioning organs, legs bound in string. I swear I believe in the circle of life. I usually eat vegetarian, but for environmental reasons rather than animal rights sympathies. I'm not disgusted by the chicken. I am in awe of it and of the transformation it's about to undergo from a hunk of meat to a gourmet dish. I try to picture this lemon-hearted lump of flesh in the oven, morphing into that promised moist golden balloon, a dead pink Cinderella in a tin pan. And I had written, I'm not even sure I've ever handled a body this way, so unceremoniously, but on thinking of it, I think it was pretty ceremonious, so...
It was.
Yeah, I've sort of changed my mind about what I wrote at the time. But
tell us more about that, because I want to pursue this question a little bit. It's unceremonious, and yet, oh, wait a minute.
Well, it just seemed like you're sort of, I guess I'd written unceremonious because you're sort of abusing the body in a way, but it really is with a lot of respect, at least the way that we did it in class.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this idea, so, Molly. I want to stay right there for a second because there is this fine line between appreciating and being thoughtful and intentional about food and then fetishizing food and cuisine. Mm-hmm. When cooking becomes cuisine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that and where this fine line is and whether you think sometimes we all go a little too far.
I think we all go a little too far. I think Anna's experience is emblematic of one of those moments when you understand the dignity of an animal giving its life for sustenance and the very ritualistic aspect of preparing that body to be transformed and for the magic of heat to work on that body. And it's not a haphazard transformation. It takes intelligent hands. It takes a lot of experience to do it very well. It takes all of the human senses. That kind of ritual is something that I'm all over. When we move to a more fetishized kind of ritual, you know, what is the exact viscosity of, you know, the chicken meat at this temperature and that temperature, and how do we measure that and how do we calibrate that? And can we turn that into a foam? And can we deconstruct that? And if we deconstruct it, then what's the proper presentation? And what's the irony involved? And you're losing me. Mm-hmm. You're losing me. And what you're doing is robbing the experience of its sensuality and of its heart and of its connection to a larger world. And you're reducing its reference only to the cook. I mean, this is S&M cuisine.
Well, and it's also, it suggests the difference between only the cook and not participating in the process.
Exactly.
So waiting for the presentation and oohing and aahing over the thing on your plate without taking any part in that messy business, but ritualistic experience of caring for the carcass.
Well, and it's also dominance. It's not a dance. You know, this cook was working with that chicken. But when you begin to dominate the ingredient and your idea of what it can be becomes larger than what it is, then I think we have a real problem.
Fabulous to talk with all of you. Thank you so much for being on the program today. Molly O'Neill, author of One Big Table. Molly speaks tomorrow night at 5:30 in Hyde Hall's University Room. A book signing is going to follow. The event is free and open to the public. It's part of UNC's Food Cultures Student Symposium. I also want to thank Lauren Wilson and Anna Castle, who were with us as well today on The State of Things. Coming up on the program, visual art pioneer Carolee Schneeman. Stay with us.